Everything else is dying, but I should say, we also noticed that there was some buckwheat that was stunted but did not die, and dandelions are almost getting totally resistant glyphosate. It stunted, there were some dandelions there too, but primarily there was canola that should have died when it was sprayed with glyphosate.
And that's the super weeds.
Sorry?
That's what you call super
that's
weeds.
That's what we first discovered. This shows it about 3 weeks later, and the grain is starting, the wheat is starting to ripen. Now what we did, not only after that other, when we give it another shot, we went back to these spots and we give it another dose, and we used Roundup to make sure that it was Roundup canola. Another dose of Roundup, we sprayed it. Not only that, we give it 2 shots or 8 ounces of Bio-B600 2,4-D, which is the most powerful 2,4-D you can get. And I hate to say it, but that 2,4-D contains 70% Agent Orange. Mm. And that took 2 shots of LB600 or 2,4-D and a double dose of Roundup. That's how powerful those canola plants are.
My question, why would you keep that seed though?
Why? Oh, we didn't.
The core papers, I'm just fact checking at this point. They said that you had kept that seed and loaded it in a truck.
Okay, what went into the truck was from the first rounds around the field. See, it wasn't because there was other seed used. That was only part of the seed, like you see. But we didn't know at that time exactly what happened.
Oh, did it ever occur, did the thought ever cross your mind to sue Monsanto at that point or somebody for damages?
No, because we didn't know really. There was nothing in our papers. It was not even known there was a patent on seed at that time. Again, we're going into harvest, and you can see the canola is going into pods. This is the exact spot. Right here is where Monsanto laid the lawsuit against it. Right this here. This is field number 2, as it was called. That's where the lawsuit was laid, you see?
What year is this?
1998.
These pictures?
1998. No, 1999, because I seeded wheat.
With 2 seasons before when they were sampling right there in that same location.
Yeah, well, it was in 1998. See, 1997 doesn't really come into the picture. It was 1998
farmer. Right, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Now, here's a farmer that never seeded canola. See the contamination he's got? We, a lot of times, will leave our land idle for 1 year. We call it summer following. And in this case, this farmer didn't cultivate because he's got relatively light land, and so we always have to be concerned about soil drifting or soil erosion. So he chose to use Roundup to kill his weeds and not work his land. He gave this 2 shots of Roundup, and you can see the contamination he's got. And that had to come in by direct seed movement because he never grew canola on that land. But he sure had lots of it now. But again, one plant like that can produce from 4,000 to 10,000 seeds. That's why it has spread so quickly. When I was not allowed in 19, the judgment didn't come out until the year 2001. But my lawyers advised me that I shouldn't use my seed for planting. And so I went to a seed company and I bought I think the first time I bought seed for many, many years, because we were seed developers, you see. And then we took, along with the Department of Agriculture from Saskatchewan, we took Roundup, where we sprayed just a small quantity to check how contamination-free this canola seed was. We found that 12 to 15% was contaminated with Monsanto's GMOs because we used their chemical Roundup on it. So, if Monsanto would have found out about this, I would have had another lawsuit because I was growing their GMO canola without a license. Again, rate of contamination doesn't mean anything. Now, it doesn't only, it's in our cities, our towns, and especially like corporate telephone, corporate, and power. They generally maintain weed control around their property or poles. See what has happened? Everything else has died. Except the super wheat canola.
When you say it's a super weed, it's basically the canola that Monsanto has developed, and if it was deliberately grown, it would not be a weed.
When it, well, you, they generally refer to volunteers.
Yeah.
Okay, you can have Monsanto's GMO canola that is resistant only to glyphosate. But now we have GMO Monsanto canola that is resistant to a multitude of chemicals.
Account of the super weed.
Pardon?
That's the super weed.
That's the super weed.
On account of the, what, the cross-pollination with the other varieties?
Super weeds can only come from cross-pollination. Again, a power corporation, and you can see it along our roadways. And an unusual thing, we know that Colorado spruce can withstand glyphosate. You can see Colorado spruce will not die with a strain of glyphosate. Something that they found. But again, look at the contamination. You can see the canola, how healthy the plants are. I had mentioned about Monsanto's police. This farmer came to my place and he said, Monsanto's police are in his field. He told them to get out, they wouldn't do it. I came with my camera and I was able to get a picture of him in the field, but I was also able to get a closer up one. Here's his place, Monsanto badge. He's got a plastic bag. He's taking leaf samples. If the grain is to the stage or the canola to pods, they'll take the pods, but otherwise they'll just take leaves. And you can use a vial test and can tell about 80% whether it's GMO or not. This farmer told this person to get out of this field. He's trespassing, taking or receiving the seed. He was just laughed at. Take us to court, but you won't have a farmer. So again, that's the intimidation and harassment. I think there's a few more overheads, but a final point I'd like to make is that my wife and I, we have 5 kids and 15 grandchildren, and we're very concerned. And what kind of a legacy do we want to leave to our children and grandchildren? Do we want to leave a legacy of land, food, and water, or soil full of poisons? No, we don't want to leave that. We want to leave land, food, and soil, and water without poisons. And that's another reason we stood up to Monsanto. And we said this, that every time Monsanto came after us, and I never touched upon the stress that went through our family. And I, you know, 6 years has been a living hell for us. You know, they threatened us. They watched us all day long as we worked in our field. They would even come into our driveway and sit there sometimes or across the road for 3 days at a time. And when my wife would come out, they would take off. Phone calls, better watch, we're going to get you. And the worst was in South Africa at the parliament, when I met face-to-face a person by the name of Wally Green from Monsanto. And I was given a presentation in Parliament, and he also gave a short presentation, but he bombed out because he said there was no such thing as cross-pollination, seeds would not move in wind, and he got laughed at. And coming out of the assembly, we ran into each other. And he shook his fist in my face and said, nobody stands up to Monsanto, we're going to get you, and we're going to destroy you somehow, and when you get back to Canada, you're going to be in big trouble. And sure enough, 3 weeks later, what happened? I got back to Canada. Another lawsuit for $1 million against me because Monsanto said I was arrogant, I was stubborn, and I wouldn't do what they said, so they wanted $1 million for their court costs. So, and then what happened after another year of trial on that? The judge, the first judge, awarded Monsanto $153,000 court costs against me besides all the profit from our 1998 crop. So it has not been easy, and that's why a lot of farmers, when they see what has happened to me, they just buckle under. You can't afford the stress and the cost of it. My wife developed high blood pressure, and coming out of, she was with me in Parliament in South Africa. She got so excited when she heard what Monsanto's rep, Wally Green, said to me, and she fell and she broke her shoulder in South Africa and they ended up in the hospital. But this is the price we're paying. She's got high blood pressure. Didn't take her medication properly one day and went down 14 steps on her head and tore the retina of one eye, her neck. And when people know this, and there's such a fear, going back to that fear culture that has been established on the Northern Plains and the prairies of Western Canada. So there's more to it than just the introduction of GMOs. and that scientists should look at, more or less in closing, should look at the long-term implications of how our biodiversity and our and pure seeds are being destroyed right around the world. Can you imagine an African farm, or a farmer in Central America, or Bangladesh, having to go out and buy their seeds each year, buy the chemicals? And I've told these African farmers that if you ever give up your right to use your own seed, you'll become serfs of the land, and you're back to a feudal system. And that'll happen here. And whoever controls the seed supply of any country will ultimately control the food supply. And in many countries, whoever controls the food supply will control that country. And to me, that's why my wife and I have taken the stand that we're, you know, that we're not going to give up. We feel that the rights of farmers to use their own seed should never, ever be taken away.
Here on the window.
I was wondering if you could talk about the role of globalization in what's going on with genetically engineered crops, the World Trade Organization, the NAFTA Treaty, and specifically the proposed free trade area of the Americas.
Well, if you remember, not that long ago, that Argentina, United States, and Canada have taken the European Union to court over the WTO. You know, under the WTO, Europe is supposed to let genetic engineering or GMOs into the country, but Europe is smart enough, they're going to get around that because they have labeling. And if and Europeans do not want GMOs from the research that has already been done. So they'll be able to stop it a different way, because if people don't buy it, there would be no sense for the importers to bring it in. But at the present time, it's still not allowed. But United States, Canada, and Argentina have brought this pressure against Europe under the WTO. What will happen in the future, I don't know.
In the back, in the middle?
You know, I'm really curious about one thing, is this decision from the courts. At least in this country, I know of, we're supposed to have constitutional rights protecting property. And I'm sure that you have them in Canada too, at least in theory. What was the justification for taking all your crop and your profits while it's become so clear that the plant grows in many places where it has not been planted on purpose? How did they justify taking away your property?
I think that's one of the reasons that the Supreme Court agreed to hear my case. But what the judge really done, the first court judge, he ruled that the patent law of Monsanto is over and above farmers' right. Because remember what I said, we have a federal law already in Canada that a farmer always has the right to use his seed from year to year. But the first judge overruled that, and that's why I think on many of those issues, that's why it's before the Supreme Court. And many of you have heard too that Monsanto did everything to discredit me. They said my crop was 95 to 98% GMOs, it would be too high a level and all that. It was their testing. Why didn't they go out and get third party testing?
Are you aware that Monsanto has carried out somewhat similar policies with respect to recombinant bovine growth hormone? That the original research was done up on the hill by Dr. Bauman and his graduate assistants, and then that this hormone was made available to dairy farmers, and some of us haven't used it, some of us had, and they've run into real problems in Maine, where there's a lawsuit instituted by Monsanto against dairy farmers claiming that they don't use that that hormone. Are you aware of that activity by Monsanto?
Yes, they tried to also patent it in Canada and was not allowed. Bovine growth hormone is not allowed in Canada. United States is the only country in the world that has allowed it. And now there's been a lot of implications on that already, and a lot of discussion, and that, but not so much from the milk, but also from the feed that animals are fed with, especially GMO corn or GMO soybeans. And like hog farmers already have found by being fed, animals being fed with this corn or soybeans will have difficulty reproducing, especially in pigs. Cows, they have found Minnesota, Wisconsin, do not produce milk like it should be. In fact, I had a phone call from a scientist about a year ago and he wanted to know the names of farmers in the U.S. that were having problem with milk production after the cattle or cows were GMO soybeans or corn. And he said, if it affects cow's milk, what is it doing to a mother who's breastfeeding her baby eating GMO foods? So there is people concerned about that aspect.
I was just curious, what sort of support do you get from what sort of support do you get from your local and federal police forces in Canada? I mean, you're obvious. I mean, the activities around your farm must be quite obvious. But do you suspect complicity with local police?
Well, you have to lay a charge. The farmer has to lay a charge. And when you lay a charge, Monsanto will fight it. And it's got to go through the court system. But I did, and that one farmer I showed that picture, I went with him to the RCMP. But you got to remember, the Monsanto's gene police are ex-RCMP. They're former colleagues. And like the sergeant, one of them said to me, but they only took such a little bit. And I said, for God's sakes, if I go to the bank and steal $1 or $5,000, it's the same. And when he said that, and you know, but he said, all right, to the farmer, go lay a charge.
Two questions and a comment. Number one, what's your website address?
Oh, okay. It's www.percyschmeiser.com, and there's a lot of information. In fact, you on that website, you can get the complete factum of my whole case in the Supreme Court and all of the issues, a lot that I didn't mention.
So the one comment I had was that one other area of concern is that if you go to the USDA website, you can see how much money the government is putting toward research, and a lot of it's going toward ornamental plants, which will soon be in your neighbor's yard or whatever. You know, it's not just food anymore. But my other question, what kind of, when Monsanto is growing their canola seed, what kind of buffer zone do they require around their fields to keep conventional crops from contaminating their pure genetic?
We don't know, because we know there's no, you can't contain it, and they know that.
But I mean, could you?
But originally they said 9 feet.
Just a comment about the bovine growth hormone. Monsanto is losing ground. Some of you may have read my letter to the editor today. Monsanto is delaying introducing genetically engineered wheat into the environment. But on the bovine growth hormone, Monsanto yesterday released a press release that they're cutting back by 50% their Prozalac, which is the bovine growth hormone. The reason is that they're making some corrections. Now, the source of our information hasn't come forward yet, but apparently they're finding bone cancer in the cows that are being treated with the bovine growth hormone. We expect that information to be forthcoming soon. But the issue of safety testing is one that Monsanto has Attorney General Ashcroft and a number of other people in the Bush administration right now who work for Monsanto. So we can see the connection between the current administration and the and Monsanto, and we need to keep up the fight. Percy Schmeiser is probably going to be one of the greatest heroes in food history.
Yeah.
I should be. Thank you. Thank you.
You said yield is down and pesticide use is up with GMO crops. And
I can argue.
You said yield is down and pesticide use is up with GMO crops. Is anyone doing research on that? And could that research be used to chip away at the, you know, public relations, you know, stuff that Monsanto puts out to farmers?
The question is, if yield is down and pesticide use is up, couldn't that, what kind of data is there out there to support that, and couldn't that be used to chip away at Monsanto's PR?
If you go to my website, you'll see on that website, you'll see the Royal Society of Canada, which come down with a damage ring. It was set up by the Canadian government to look into the GMO or the super weeds and so on, and they came back with a damaging report against the Monsanto or the Canadian government even. And so go to my website and look for Royal Society of Canada's report on GMOs.
Also, Charles Benbrook, who used to work for the USDA, has a lot of research on how much more pesticide is being used.
Right. Yes.
Look him up under Google, you'll find him.
One more question here in the back.
Yeah, I thought you said in the beginning that you had a lawsuit yourself because they had contaminated your crops, and I was wondering what happened with that. And my other question was, I was recently talking to a local farmer who does GMO corn, and he was telling me that he gets such a high yield from that, and that's how he does it. And I understand GMO corn is very big in the United States, so I was wondering if that crop reduction is also good for corn in this country.
First of all, I do have a lawsuit against Monsanto in a provincial court, which is called Court of Queen's Bench. It was registered and filed almost a year or before a year after the lawsuit was launched against me by Monsanto. I had to file it at that time, a statute of limitation, but it has not been proceeded with. Because how many battles can I fight at once? But as soon as the Supreme Court is over, then we're planning to proceed with it. I should also mention that there's about 550 lawsuits against farmers in the United States, or Canada and the United States right now by Monsanto. And they're in abeyance until they see what happens with my case now in the Supreme Court. But can you imagine how these farmers feel every morning they wake up? I wonder what's the outcome of my case going to be, and will they have a farm left? There's a lot of fear out there.
That was Canadian farmer Percy Schmeiser speaking last week in Ithaca on corporate power and patents on life. Thanks to Jeff Kirby for recording this for us. If you're outraged, don't go away mad. Do something about it. At both talks, organizers were taking names of people interested in getting more involved in the issues. In the Ithaca area, contact Aaron Riddle of the Finger Lakes Sierra Club, which was one of the sponsors of Schmeiser's talk. You can reach her at 256-993, 256-993 in the 607 area code. And on the Cornell campus, you can contact Anka Wessels of CRESP, which is located in Annabelle Taylor Hall. Telephone 255-5027, 255-5027 in the 607 area code. If you can't write this down at the moment, don't worry. The info will be on the Unwelcome Guests website, unwelcomeguests.org, in our show archive under show 189. That's under show 189. You can also download an MP3 of the program from our archive, burn a CD, and distribute this information to your friends, neighbors, and elected officials. Since October, I've been reading from the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. The book deals with the ideological nature of professional work in society and the training and certification process that perpetuates the social status quo by ensuring that the people who end up in socially influential fields of work are people comfortable with the present power structure and are willing to accept its ideological discipline. Last week I began Chapter 10, Examining the Examination, which I'll conclude this week. This chapter deals with the ideological mechanism of graduate school qualifying examinations. The author looks beneath the apparently apolitical technical questions used in a physics exam to show how the ideological screening process works by screening for students comfortable with rote memorization and decontextualized work. What about examination problems that do not require tricks? Do these problems, too, favor the memorizer over the individual whose primary tools are creativity and insight? The answer is yes. And the reason is the structure of the examination, in particular, its time pressure and the fragmentary nature of its problems. Work done under time pressure, be it craft work, service work, or intellectual work, is easy to spot. Because people under time pressure don't simply do faster work, they do different work. It is of lower quality. Similarly, time pressure on an examination calls for and rewards a particular approach to problems, A timed examination favors students who are comfortable grinding out answers to problems without taking the time to develop insight into the situations described in the problems. Coming up with correct answers, which many students do by mechanically following similar test preparation problems that they have memorized, certainly does not imply understanding. Students who are comfortable only when they proceed on the basis of a comprehensive understanding, for example, physical science students who can work with confidence on a problem only by developing a feeling for the physical situation described in the problem, or biological science students who require a feeling for the organism, or social science students who cannot work without a feeling for the social situation. These students are at a disadvantage on a timed test. Such students gain insight into a problem by looking at special cases, by exploring interesting blind alleys, most of which turn out to be dead ends, by thinking about analogous situations and so on, all of which take valuable time from other problems on the test, resulting in lower scores. The qualifying examination favors students who take a conservative approach to problems, a narrow, mission-oriented approach based on the memorization of large numbers of test preparation problems. Disfavored are students who take a broad, explanatory approach based on developing a feeling for what is going on in the problems. The typical qualifying examination problem is actually only a fragment of a real problem. It is a technical part of a problem, or part of a technical part of a problem. That the social or even physical context in which the problem arises is rarely specified hurts some students and helps others. It saps the motivation of people for whom a problem is more than a puzzle, people for whom the solution to a problem is not the last line in a calculation, but is a statement about the situation in which the problem arises. That statement, of course, may be based on a calculation. These people, who want to explore the problem in its context, who get satisfaction from the impact of their work within the context, who often do their best work solving whole problems, where one must sort out relevant and irrelevant information in disorderly and confusing situations. These people are judged to be qualified or unqualified in their profession by their response to the problem fragments that the examination throws at them. For those who have adopted a rote, mechanistic approach, however, the narrowness of the assigned problems is not an obstacle. In fact, these people are often more comfortable with technical sub-problems than they are with the whole problems, where the context is a distraction or a source of anxiety. The qualifying examination's time restrictions and content restrictions both select for students who take a narrow approach to problems. Such restrictions make the examination much like a game. A high-stakes game in which it is imperative that you take a narrow approach if you want to be a serious contender. A game in which winning simply means that you are good at the narrow approach. These restrictions are similar to those under which most scientists and other professionals employed throughout the corporate government university complex do their assigned work. Hence, by rewarding the narrow approach, the seemingly objective examination puts the label most qualified on those who are best suited to serve employing institutions as narrow problem solvers. Time pressure and fragmented problems on a qualifying examination may appear to be testing for some politically transcendent speed skill or technical skill, but are actually testing for the narrow approach that institutions demand of their professional employees. In this sense, these skills themselves are political. The inextricable connection between skill and approach blows the cover of political neutrality on skill. I should emphasize that this kind of discussion about people who take a narrow-minded approach to problems is necessarily a discussion of professionals rather than non-professionals, because non-professionals are not trusted to extrapolate memorized solutions and apply them to new situations, even in a narrow-minded way. Non-professionals are expected, in essence, to approach problems with a closed mind, to follow carefully instructions that specify in detail how to handle routine problems, and to refer deviant problems to professional employees in the organization. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Continuing on with the next subsection titled Boredom and Endurance. Examinations that span many hours or many days test something that shorter examinations do not. Endurance. Does this feature of qualifying examinations act neutrally? That is, does the endurance obstacle merely work to weed out those who are not genuinely interested in the subject? Or does it favor some types of interest in the subject over others? The answer to this question follows from a look at the potential mismatch between a student's interest in a profession and the profession's primary role in society. I have described how professional qualifying examinations are indirect in the way they test for the values that characterize the professional. Such examinations work largely through their structure and could be built around any aspect of the relevant professions and still end up selecting and rejecting more or less the same people. Nevertheless, the aspect emphasized on a qualifying examination is not arbitrary, and it serves to fine-tune the selection process. Although people within a profession work at a variety of jobs, each emphasizing a different set of skills, the profession's qualifying examination is often based on just one set of skills, the skills needed to do the type of work that the profession does as its main social function. This is the case for professions whose qualifying examinations are given after a couple of years of graduate school, as in the natural and social sciences, as well as for professions whose qualifying examinations are given just before admission to professional training, as in the medical professions. Today's typical physicist, for example, is employed to solve technical problems for industry or government, and so it is no surprise that the examination given to students wishing to enter physics emphasizes calculations, making it in part a test of the student's ability and, because of the commitment required, willingness to attack such problems. In fact, the examination consists almost exclusively of calculations, as if calculations are all there is to the subject. Even students who want to enter the field to pursue philosophical issues, to challenge the direction of the field, to demystify the field for the benefit of the general public, or simply as an end in and of itself to comprehend the field's insights into the world, even these students must, as a condition of admission, demonstrate through the calculational examination their ability to serve the military-industrial complex. The physics student who wants a career designing missile guidance systems is not required to know much about the philosophical foundations of physics. But the physics student who wants to pursue the philosophical issues is required to demonstrate employability by the aerospace industry. The field admits new members on this basis, not because the calculations are more basic than the philosophical foundations, and not for any other technical reason, but because the field is an integral part of the larger social and economic system. In general, the particular set of technical skills that you would need in order to help carry out a field's primary role in serving the system comes to define what people in the field speak of as the basic skills that everyone entering the field should have. A short examination would not be able to distinguish reliably between students who have these skills and students who are merely familiar with them. Students taking a qualifying examination are likely to have at least some interest in every facet of the profession they are seeking to enter, including some interest in the profession's primary function in the system. And the skills deriving from this interest might be enough to get them through a short test. It takes a long examination to separate the men from the boys to use a repulsive metaphor made appropriate by the competitive male-gendered atmosphere in most fields. Students with a deviant interest in the subject have a common reaction to a protracted examination that is oriented not toward their interest in the field, but toward the field's main function in the system. It is the same reaction that they have to the months-long process of preparing for such a test. They find it a bore, an agonizing chore. In contrast, students who feel at home with the examination's orientation find the week-long test an exciting challenge. The marathon test is their game. Those with a deviant interest in the subject can play this game too because it is one aspect of their field, but the endurance test exposes their limited tolerance for it. As the ordeal drags on, hour after hour, day after day, the mind of the student with a deviant interest wanders. This student has an increasingly difficult time concentrating, and at some point during the examination is likely to resign mentally. Clearly, an endurance obstacle does not act neutrally in a test. On a typical qualifying examination, it acts to weed out students who are merely interested in their field's primary role in the system, and to select students who are comfortable with and committed to the kind of work involved in playing that role. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. And continuing with the next subsection, Technical Details, Naked Formulas, and, quote, Usefulness. When outsiders thumb through the pages of a qualifying examination, they often comment that the test looks very advanced. Indeed, the test is advanced, but not necessarily along the lines they have in mind. Some naive observers, knowing that they are looking at an examination for admission to a profession, assume they are looking at questions that test the candidate's ability to assess the underlying principles of the subject, to critique the foundations upon which the subject is built. What they are really looking at, however, are questions that are advanced down the road to narrow specialization, questions that avoid critical examination of the fundamentals through their burial in the technical details of specialized applications. The skills required for decoration with the mantle of qualification, the advanced degree, indicate clearly the kind of work the individual is being prepared to do. The ability to examine critically the ideological and social framework of the field is, of course, a prerequisite for anyone challenging the field's view of the world or role in the world. Those hired by corporations or the government to do research or development work, or by universities to do normal paradigm work, need no such critical ability, and in fact will work more harmoniously without it. The qualifying examination's narrow focus on technical detail makes it an appropriate test for these rank-and-file experts, who will be employed to work uncritically within an assigned ideological and social framework, and who will therefore live in a world where only technical detail remains. It's no surprise, then, that developing a critical view of the field is an extracurricular activity, one that the training institutions discourage not only through the test's exclusive focus on the technical details of specialized applications, but also through its coverage of a large number of such applications. One reason students are reluctant to look into critical views of their field is that the time devoted to do so would leave them that much less technically expert. As a result, the students who are the most likely to pass the test and get professional credentials are often the ones prepared to do little more than render technical service to employers within the given ideological and social framework. One common feature of the many characteristics of the qualifying examination discussed in this chapter is that they all place a higher value on unexamined production than on understanding. These characteristics of the exam include its emphasis on memorized tricks, a mechanistic approach, work under time pressure, problem fragments, endurance, confinement to technical detail, and comfort with the separation of theory and experiment. Another way the test shows its orientation toward uncritical production is by the type of answers it deems valid. Almost all questions on physics examinations, for example, are designed to have answers that are formulas rather than explanations or discussions of meaning or significance. The formula is seen not as a tool to help with an explanation, but as the answer. The supposition is that the formula answers, which are often approximations that bear little resemblance to more exact formula answers, say it all, and so students usually are not even asked to interpret them. That the formula, not the explanation or discussion of significance, is the final answer, reveals values embedded in the examination. Valued is the concise, instrumentalistic summary of nature, the naked formula, a recipe sufficient for manipulating nature, but sorely insufficient for understanding nature. Even something as simple as a weight hanging on a string illustrates the point. Why does the weight swing back and forth after you give it a push? What can you say about its motion in terms of forces, velocities, and accelerations? Is the acceleration ever horizontal? Where is it zero? Most physicists would have trouble answering these questions, yet they can perform a mathematical derivation routine that yields, for example, an approximate formula for the time that the pendulum takes to swing back and forth. The qualification system's values, which reflect the larger system's need for people who will engage in unexamined production, tell students that by obtaining formula answers, they have done the most important work of the physicist, and so students are only slightly embarrassed when questions like those above expose their lack of feeling for what is going on. Their embarrassment is much greater when they forget a routine for deriving a formula. For simple and complex problems alike, it is very common for students to obtain the right answer somewhat mindlessly, without grasping what is going on, or even with a fundamental misunderstanding. On the very last line of an exam answer that gets 100% credit, one often sees a formula with a rectangle drawn around it. In the culture of science, the box says not only, this is the answer, but also, this is what is of value. Whether one is inclined to box a formula or an explanation or statement about meaning is a question of values. The examination announces its values and priorities for the subject by making the formula the goal and the end of the problem. The bottom line in every sense of the word. In this value system, anything that follows the formula is seen more as commentary than substance. It is no accident that the bottom line on questions used to select scientists today is the formula, the recipe that science gives to engineering. The formula answer is simply another way in which the values of a society dominated by a powerful military corporate university complex show up in questions that are supposedly, quote, pure science. Selecting new scientists with a test that places higher values on recipes than on explanations or discussions of meaning is one of the many ways in which university scientists serve the needs of employers. The examination's values help adjust students for employment in the military corporate university complex, where much of the work even dispenses with formula results and uses numerical computer methods to go directly to the most quantitative form of all, arrays of numbers. For students who seek to grasp the understanding of the world offered by the field, but not as a way of preparing to serve the technical needs of the military corporate university complex, the adjustment of priorities from explanations to uninterpreted formulas represents a greater loss than the final adjustment from formulas to numbers. Without developing an intuitive feeling for the subject, the scientist cannot critically examine the paradigms that he or she uses, does not have a sense of what the field can and cannot do, and is less able than the hobbyist to use the field independently outside of workplace assignments. Hence, the qualifying examination's priority on recipes over understanding, or equivalently, its use of recipes as the measure of understanding, produces scientists whose only real ability is to serve the system. The system protects itself by producing people with know-how rather than people with know-why. The system is set up to produce servants, not critics, and it succeeds at this in part by propagating a culture of science that is fundamentally uncritical. The uncritical nature of this culture is revealed clearly by the values of those who are in it, by the kind of activity that they feel is most worthwhile. In this culture, physicists who take care of technical details, but who do not question the ideological and social framework in which they are working, or who come up with formulas or numbers but do not develop an intuitive feeling for the physics of the problems on which they are working, such physicists do not see themselves as technical servants uncritically meeting the needs of the military, corporate, university complex, but simply as physicists doing what is useful. In this culture, the rare physicist who engages in critical examination of the field and its role in society is seen as doing work that is at best less useful and at worst not even a legitimate part of the field. Thus, at the University of California, Berkeley, physics professor Charles Schwartz was denied a pay step advance after he switched the focus of his research and publishing from theoretical atomic and elementary particle physics to the critical examination of the social role of physics. A university dean explained the denial to the chairman of the physics department in a letter marked strictly confidential. And the letter said, "I am sorry to tell you that the proposed merit increase for Charles L. Schwartz to Professor 3 effective July 1, 1976 has not been approved. Dr. Schwartz is a good undergraduate classroom teacher and a successful PhD director. Reviewers, other members of the physics faculty, and I do not, however, believe that his work since 1970 can be considered scholarship in physics. Although every department gives its faculty wide latitude in choosing an area for research, this latitude is not infinite. If Professor Schwartz were doing scholarly work in a field unrelated to physics, this work should not and could not be used as the basis for a merit increase in the physics department. His contributions in all other areas are sufficiently satisfactory that should he produce first-rate research in physics as he has done in the past, advancement would seem assured." The culture of science encourages students to feel a sense of accomplishment when they complete assignments, even when they do so uncritically and without developing an intuitive feeling for the work. After all, such work is useful. Indeed, uncritical, unintuitive work is useful to individual employers and to the system as a whole, because it gets the job done without challenging the ideology and social agenda that it advances. But for the same reason, it is not useful to those who want to make such a challenge, or even those who just want to have a say in the ideology or social role of their own work. An examination favors people who feel a sense of accomplishment when they do the type of work that it rewards. People who are comfortable with the established order feel a sense of accomplishment when they complete uncritical, unintuitive work that the order deems useful, and are therefore favored by the qualifying examination, whose emphasis on taking care of technical details with an unquestioned ideological and social framework and de-emphasis on explanations rewards an uncritical, unintuitive approach. The uncritical culture is powerful, so that even people who oppose the present order intellectually, if they haven't internalized their opposition, may too feel a sense of accomplishment when they serve the system well. Workers who are not critics, that is, workers who don't ask themselves whose social agenda a particular work assignment advances, and who thereby fail to determine for themselves whether the work is worthwhile and whether a personal sense of accomplishment is in order, are doomed to serve the system whose culture determines these things for them. Albert Einstein never took a physics qualifying examination. If he were going through professional training today, however, he would be judged at some point by such a test. One can imagine an examiner seating Einstein in a cubicle, handing him a set of questions about the technical details of specialized problems, looking at the clock and announcing, "You've got 2 hours. Show us what you're worth." An Einstein would not stand out on such a test, but his score would be meaningful nonetheless. It would be a good measure of his ability to serve the military corporate university complex, that is, to do useful work, not his ability to look critically at the field's role in the world or view of the world. The system measures human beings and the field itself by their ability to serve the established order. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives, by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. And continuing on to the concluding subsection of Chapter 10, the subsection is titled, The Elitist's Advantage. Qualifying examinations hold theory in higher regard than experiment, and thereby favor students who do the same. An examination is a statement as well as a measure, and those who agree with the values that a test proclaims have the advantage of feeling at home during the months of arduous study that lead up to it. In physics, qualifying examinations declare their higher regard for theoretical work over experimental work, both through their content and through their form. The simple fact that the test determines who is qualified to go on to work in the field concentrates on how to do things with theory, almost to the complete exclusion of how to do things with real materials, is a strong statement about what the examiners think is most important in the professional physicist. Also, the examination takes a primarily written form. Even the relatively short oral section is held in a classroom rather than a lab, and a material object is rarely brought in to serve as the object of discussion. A student's insight, creativity, and intuition regarding the nature of nature, derived from experiences in the garage, workshop, or lab, or simply the experience that follows from a general interest in working with physical objects, go almost completely undetected by the examination. The test is more sensitive to knowledge about the nature of models of nature, derived from textbook practice with the dominant paradigm, and from a general orientation toward theory. To those who feel that the hierarchy of social status associated with the theorist-experimenter division of labor is proper, it makes perfect sense that the test emphasizes that pure thought that stands above the grime of the laboratory. Students with such elitist beliefs are often happy never to have contact with the actual objects of the theory they are studying. These students naturally study the subject in just the way the examination presents it, and therefore end up having an advantage on the test. On the other hand, students who are less taken by the status of theory, or who simply seek a more complete knowledge of physics, will not see the examination's version of their subject as glamorous, because for them, work with symbols out of the context of work with things is simply dry and boring. These people, whose interest, development, skill, and very understanding of physics derive from their encounter with the interplay between experiment and theory, a totality that professional physicists have experienced less and less over the years, will be at a distinct disadvantage in trying to prepare for the qualifying examination. Thus, the qualification test favors those who support the hierarchical division of labor, those with elitist beliefs. The fact that a system of professional qualification favors elitists should come as no big surprise. After all, employers typically trust professionals to help maintain hierarchy in the workplace and, through their work, elsewhere in society. One result of a selection system that ranks theory higher than experiment, and that by implication accepts the separation of the two, is the creation of specialists who have little ability to deal with theory and experiment in an integrated or even connected manner. These people, and I have encountered many over the years, perform well on the tests but flounder or give answers that are embarrassingly unrealistic. When asked to explain one or another of the many physical phenomena that appear in everyday life. Clearly, the division of labor is a problem not only for physicists but for physics as well. Other fields suffer from the same problem. We have seen in the chapter how the distinct lack of enthusiasm that many otherwise enthusiastic students show for qualifying examination problems is understandable in terms of the student's sensitivity to the examination's unstated social framework, that of the status quo. That framework is imposed by identification of the isolated technical puzzles, first with career tracking and intelligence testing, second with the field's past and present service to the system, and third with alienated and unsatisfying work performed under authoritarian social conditions. The qualifying examination favors those most willing and able to do work within the social framework of the status quo. Those comfortable with the status quo are the ones whose enthusiasm for performing intellectual labor is least likely to be dampened by a lack of knowledge of and control over the social goals of their work assignments, the ones least troubled by surrendering this key element of the creative control of their work to those who see and oversee the big picture. Similarly, those who favor the qualifying examination system often turn out to be the least critical of social hierarchy and the dominant ideology, that is, the least critical of existing power relationships and, therefore, the least progressive politically. The social framework imposed by the examination problems and by the rest of the qualification system maps out a domain of allowed activity that ultimately becomes the playpen of the non-radical credentialed expert and the cage of the individual working for progress in the social structure. To have any chance of success, the latter must step outside the confines of professional work. And that was Chapter 10, Examining the Examination, from the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. For more information on Disciplined Minds, how to get a hold of the book, or how to contact the author, visit disciplinedminds.com. And if you'd like to contact us on the program, you could do so through our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. By